There was one question from yesterday which I didn't answer, which is sometimes. Oh, okay. Sometimes K equals karma, very, very funny. One who writes many, many random words needs silence inside. Please discuss, venerable sir. Okay, sometimes when there are lots and lots and lots and lots and lots of questions, it means one is quite restless. And when one is silent, then all the questions disappear. But anyway, dear venerable, this is one of my observations. When a person is dying a natural death of age 80 years without any sickness by packing up organ by organ, slowly the body getting cold, part by part, starting from the legs, there is no pulse within 6 hours, respiratory system not working, senses, brain not working, according to the doctor. So how does this person take a breath random? Is this vichama? Vinyana, the consciousness. The entire body is cold, no pulse, but taking a random breath. When I questioned the doctor said, this is what science cannot explain. I observed this with my mum's last moments, even without pulse. Even with a cold body, one eye was opened and closed, and it was a last breath. Please explain, with metta, this is what happens when somebody dies. This is, you know, the idea of the connection between the brain and the mind. And this is an common question which people keep asking. And of course, being a scientist, you have to quote the evidence. And the evidence is there from people like Professor John Lorb of Sheffield University. That's the first fellow which I read, have found a boy without a brain. He was doing some research on the shape of the human skull. And if he saw anywhere at Sheffield University whose head was slightly misshaped, he invited him onto the research program, and he saw this one student, a boy. He was an honors graduate in mathematics. He was doing postgrad work. And his head was slightly misshaped, so he invited him onto the program, gave him a CT scan, and found he had no brain. It was just filled with cerebral fluid. And that would cause a huge problem for all the people who think that somehow or other the mind is some byproduct of the brain. There was a guy who didn't have a brain at all. And I remember one of those retreats I was teaching in Sydney, a doctor was taking me to the retreat centre, and we were talking about that. He'd seen that CT scan. He said it was done a couple of times just to make sure there was no error there. And he said, you wouldn't believe just how many problems that one CT scan is causing science, threatening $1 billion of research. But of course what happened, it was just put in the anomaly file. In other words, it's just too difficult and it challenges too many cherished opinions. But there's been other people found with hardly any brain at all. Certainly the amount of brain they got left nowhere near explains the higher brain functions of memory and being able to do honors mathematics. So that was one example. The other examples, which I was getting confused earlier, Professor Pim van Lommel, who started doing research into people who have NDEs, near-death experiences. These are people who, when they have some sort of trauma, like an operation or a road accident, or they hear one of Ajahn Brahm's bad jokes, they have cardiac arrest and they leave their body. It's going to happen sooner or later, I don't know. And when they do leave their body, let's have a bad joke. This is one of my favorite bad jokes. It's a golden oldie again. Talking about accidents and about the two carrots. You'll know the two carrot joke. It's a golden oldie, but I started it, you have to finish it. Two carrots walking down the street, and one gets hit by a car, some drunk driver, some stupid person. And he's got so badly injured, they have to call the ambulance. And the ambulance comes within a couple of minutes, they look at the injured carrot, and he's so badly affected, they put him straight in the back of the ambulance, and with his friend, you know, inside the ambulance as well, worried, sick about what's going to happen to the injured carrot, they rush him to the hospital, and there they get him straight into the emergency room. The triage nurses take one look at him, he needs an emergency operation. So straight into the theatre, And the poor friend, Mr. Cabot's in the waiting room, worried like hell whether his mate's going to make it or not. After 2 hours, the surgeon came through and said, you know, I've got some news about your friend, the injured Carrot. There's good news and bad news. The good news is he's going to survive. He managed to save his life. The bad news is because of his brain injuries, he's going to be a vegetable for the rest of his life. Did anybody die? He's a cow. He's going to be a vegetable for the rest of his life. Okay. I love that joke. That's what I think is really funny. So, part of being, you know, who you are, what you are, you tell your jokes. You don't care if anybody else likes them. I like them, so I'm going to tell them. So that's it. So you don't. That's one of the things which happens when you really get into the meditation. You get insight. You get wise. You don't care what other people think of you. You just have a good time. So anyway, back to Pim van Lommel. So he was a doctor in 3 hospitals over in the Netherlands. He heard about near-death experiences, people, you know, floating out of their body, being able to hear things. You know. Do they hear real things, or is it just imagination? So what did he want to do research into this. So his sample base was every patient who came into one of these 3 hospitals over a space of about 3 months or 6 months, I can't remember how long, who came in under cardiac arrest. And those who survived, he gave questionnaires to. And at the same time, when they're in the ER room or having an operation, he'd record, you know, what happened. So if they did remember something, he could check to see whether it was real memory or whether it was fake imagination. And he had this huge number of people who survived. Some of them, about 10%, I think it was, had these NDEs, near-death experiences. What they said they'd heard and seen, you know, when they were unconscious, was actually true. So you could actually say that these are real experiences. You don't imagine them. What you hear actually was said. What happened, you know, did actually occur. But to his surprise, the reason why his research became very famous, he found those 10% who had these near-death experiences were the ones who were brain dead as well. The brain was not functioning at that time. The brain was functioning, they were under cardiac arrest, the heart had stopped, but the brain was still okay. Then they never had the NDEs. And that was an incredible piece of insight which he had. And from that time on, he realized, look, this consciousness which happens when you die, where you can see and hear floating above the body and all that sort of stuff, that cannot be produced by the brain. And that was his great conclusion. This must be another phenomena. It was one of the first times, very, very strong evidence that the mind does not depend upon the brain. Because at that time, the brain is totally dysfunctional. And that evidence has been continued to be amassed, and it's pretty convincing these days. So, what happens when you actually die? What happens when a person dies? Actually, that mind starts to separate, becomes independent from the brain. So it doesn't need the brain anymore. And when it separates, that's when you get clarity. So when you're dying, usually you're drugged up to the eyeballs with morphine and other painkillers. And so your brain is just really stuffed up. And it's also the dying process, there's all sorts of other stuff gets secreted into your brain. So the brain is just really, really sort of malfunctioning at that time. But it gets to a certain point and then the mind sort of separates. And that's when you can see, hear, and actually do things. And the classic example was of, it was in Time magazine. I should have kept the article, but it was, you know, written by a bona fide medical practitioner dealing with one of his patients who had a brain tumor. And the brain tumor, it was inoperable. You could see how it was going to take over the brain of this patient. And you could actually time it. You could see how it was growing, growing, growing. And as it grew and took over more of the brain, you could actually predict what would happen. You know, this function paralyzed, then would not be able to speak, and then would, you know, lose memory, and then would lose all the other functions of the brain. I'm not quite sure what the order was. But of course, the last thing was, the last part of the brain would just be able to keep the heart and the lungs going, the brain going. It was the last part, the most important bodily functions. And then, when there's no brain left to look after the heart and the lungs, then you die. And so he could actually predict it and say, probably, you know, sometime on Tuesday afternoon, he will die. So all the family were there around his bedside. He'd been in a coma for about a week or something because of the brain been taken over by the tumour. They were just holding his hand, waiting for him to die. When he opened his eyes, leant up and had a nice conversation with all his family for 15 minutes. And of course that was totally impossible, but the doctor said it happened. He was there. So the last 15 minutes he was totally clear and he could actually control his body when at that time there was no brain left. So that's what happens. The mind takes over when you're dead. And so if you've got a relation, like my mother died last year of, she had dementia for about 3 years. And if you're concerned about, you know, a family member who's got dementia, it's not a nice thing to see someone who you've known and loved, you know, not being able to remember you or remember anybody. But I wasn't there when she died because I was over here in Australia, but I'm absolutely certain what would have happened if I'd have been there the last minute or 2 minutes. When the mind separated from the brain, she would have opened her eyes. Oh, Peter, how are you doing? How are things over in Australia? She'd have been totally aware with all her memory coming back again. And that is, some people have told me, they've actually seen that with their demented parents. The last moments, just before they die, mind separating from the brain. The brain is a trouble. The brain is malfunctioning. And the mind is actually making use of that. But when the mind actually separates, then you can actually remember everything and you're clear again. That's an important part for Buddhists because we always say that the last moments before you die, that's crucial for your rebirth. So in other words, you don't have to worry about taking the morphine and thinking, oh my God, I'm going to be drugged to the eyeballs. I don't know where I'm going to get reborn. I'm just totally out of it. Don't worry about that because the last moments you'll become clear. Now the first time I read that was actually in a short story by Tolstoy. I remember reading that as a student. He was saying a story about this guy who was really sick and screaming, you know, 24 hours a day, driving the people in the house crazy. And then he was describing just what that would do to a person. You know, the family and loved ones who were in the same house with him. They tried to get all sorts of doctors. Nothing could actually cure the pain, the constant pain of this guy who's moaning and screaming 24 hours a day. Everyone else was really losing it, and then suddenly he went quiet. And then for 5 minutes he was clear, no pain, and then he died. He said this was a common occurrence in the days before morphine. You know, it doesn't matter how much pain you're in, or how sick you are, the last couple of minutes are pain-free and clear. Which is a wonderful thing to know. A couple of the people here, goes to Nolamara regularly. She was holding the hand of her father with her sister either side of the bed in Charlie Gardner Hospital and waiting for her father to die. He'd been in the coma for many hours and he opened his eyes and he actually bent up and looked at his two daughters and they both said simultaneously, no plans, we love you, Dad. And then he closed his eyes and died. Again, the last moment, perfectly clear. And there's one other, I love this story as well. There's one other sort of guy I was with when he was dying. That was in the hospice in Murdoch University. And he was dying of, what was it? Some sort of cancer, you know, drugged up the eyeballs with morphine. And his last words were this. I'd always remember his last words. He was from Yorkshire, a true Englishman. And I was with him, and the daughter was a good Buddhist, and it was getting time for my lunch. You haven't had anything to eat yet. So she went out and got some KFC, because you have to have fast food, whatever you can get. And so, you know, had some chicken and chips or whatever it was. And being a English person, if you ever have chips, you always have to share it. You always say, have a chip. It's tradition. And even I always do that. And I did that in Korea. No, I didn't have any. Yes, right, I did. I was in Korea with another English guy. We had some chips and we did that. And I said, yeah, this is the old English tradition. The Koreans thought we were crazy. But her dad had been in coma and just, you know, just habit, that's all. She said, "Dad, you want a chip?" And he came out of his coma and said, "Yes, please." And this is no joke, that was the last words he said. And he died afterwards. True Englishman. I mean, that was, I'd be very proud if that was my last words. You offered me a chip. So, yeah, thank you. That was Susan Towler, Dad. Very good. Anyway, I've only done one question. I better hurry up. Is that the question? Yeah. So that's actually what's happening there. It's a nice question. Here we go. Dear Ajahn, just a curiosity question. I have a very close Christian friend who tells me that she receives messages from God. What she describes is very similar to Nimitta. Bright lights, immense happiness, and she could see formation in the clouds. She dances with the angels. It is all experienced in the mind. Does this mean Christians also experience Nimitta? Jhana, perhaps one day she can become enlightened too. It could be. Sometimes you need a bit more information to find out whether it really is Nimitta and what's actually happening, but it could be pretty close. So it really depends on the messages she receives, because sometimes that could be close to schizophrenia, so you've got to be very careful sometimes. But if it's like messages which make sense, then fine. So if you ever do have Nimittas and you hear voices, be careful. Number one, do they make sense or not? And if they're obviously ridiculous things, I mean, please don't follow them and don't go crazy. And even if you superstitious people, you know, that you want to make some money from lotteries or from stock market, and you hear the voice say, "Put money on Google, put money on Google," don't trust that. The classic story was this guy, and you know, he didn't usually hear voices, but after meditation he heard a very clear voice say to him, "Go to the casino." He said, "What?" And then he heard it again. I mean, it wasn't imagining, it was very clear. "Go to the casino." And he thought, why not? You know, because maybe some people were looking after him. So he went to the casino. When he went inside the door, he heard the voice again, really clearly, "Go to the roulette table. Go to the roulette table." He wasn't imagining it. It was like as clear as anyone else was speaking. So he went to the roulette table, and he heard the voice say, $10 on number 17. $10 on number 17. Nothing much to lose, so he got some chips for 10 bucks and put it on number 17. The croupier put the ball in the wheel, turned it around. It went in number 17. And he heard the voice said, "Yes, yes. Put all the money on number 22. Put all the winnings on number 22. So, he won already, so he put all the money on number 22. They put the ball in the wheel, turned it around, and of course it went in number 22. And he heard the voice again, "Woohoo, woohoo! Put all the money on number 16. All the money on number 16. Now he's going to win a fortune. But you know, the word was, you know, looking after him so far, so he put all of that money, about $10,000 or whatever it was, all on number 100,000, I think. Yeah. Or 10,000 or whatever. 10,000, I think it is. So he put $10,000 on number 16. And he put the ball in the wheel, turned it around, and it actually fell in number 16. But then it jumped out onto the number next to him. And he heard the voice very clearly say, "Shit. Shit." And the meaning you tell that story is because even heavenly beings make mistakes. So if you do hear a clear voice, don't follow it. It could be wrong. It can give wrong advice. So that's the difficulty of getting messages from God. Even God makes mistakes. Dear Ajahn, one afternoon in my nap, I saw a teenage female lying flat on the road, her whole body gone flat with only a bright red mandarin collar short dress left on the road. Was her spirit calling for urgent attention? It was in a city more than 600 kilometers from here. How does a highly established and revered monk like you, Ajahn, help? What can a lay person do besides crying out loud? Sadhu. Oh, I think you may have been sleeping a bit too long. because you can have all sorts of dreams in, you know, when you're asleep. So don't take them seriously. So as a nap, you saw a teenage female lying flat on the road, her whole body gone flat with only a bright red mandarin collar short. Now, what does that tell you psychologically? That tells you that you've got a fetish for flat women. Mandarin. Okay. So I don't know. It's just a dream, that's all. So don't take it seriously. It won't be a spirit asking for help, because spirits can't come into this place. You're protected. Dear Ajahn Brahm, I followed your talk this morning and it helped in my meditation to still the mind in the afternoon. Woohoo! I have never tried meditation before, and being able to learn that I can find a moment of stillness makes me grin like crazy. Absolutely. Well done. And here comes the bum. Can't you guys just finish at the first paragraph? All was alright until in late afternoon there was a sudden anxiety fear of the realization I'm wanting more. I didn't know I was wanting, and when I first came to Jhana Grove I thought, if I didn't learn anything, at least I had a good sleep for 9 days. What didn't I even realize, and now that I do, I don't like the feeling. I stopped trying and went for a walk. Can you please help? Oh yeah, remember, look, the whole purpose of coming here, as I said in the beginning, is to let go of things, not to get things. And you had a nice experience because you didn't want anything. When you don't want things, then your mind becomes still. So when you start wanting these things again, then you just create problems for yourself. So at least you're learning something. But don't learn the hard way. Learn the easy way. In other words, you make a mistake once and don't do it again. There was a story of the Buddha said about the five horses. And the first horse, the rider goes on the top and tells it where to go, and it goes there straight away. That's like a good student. And that student, I just give the advice and you understand it and you follow it straight away. The second horse is not so sharp. The rider has to get the whip out, and just the shadow falls on its body, and it realizes, oh, I better follow the instructions. That's like some of your other disciples. Yeah, I mean, I have to say it twice, but then you learn how to let go. You're a good horse. The third horse is really stupid. That when you give it the instructions, you have to tap it with the whip first of all, not hurt it. Just tap it to warn it, and then it goes, oh, I better do the right thing, otherwise I'm going to suffer. And those are the disciples. Yeah, you know, you almost get some suffering. You hear other people, I don't want to do that. So you let go, you're content, you have a nice peaceful time. The fourth horse is really stupid. You have to whack it. Ow! But only once. And when you've been hurt once, you know, you've been trying, striving, getting all frustrated and all anxious. You only do it once. You learn from your mistake. Okay, from now on I'm going to let go. Now make peace, be kind, be gentle. I'm not going to get in there again. At least you know you're a pretty good disciple, even though you're a little bit stupid. And the fifth horse, whack, 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 and still doesn't understand. And how many of you associate with the fifth horse? Every time I say, second noble truth meditation, wanting leads to suffering. Oh yeah. And then you go, want, whack. Please learn how to make peace, be kind, be gentle. Let go. Stop trying to aspire for things. Be here. Don't try and get somewhere. Just, you're here to let go, not to attain things. How can you become peaceful when you're holding the cup of water? You've got to put it down. So stop striving. Use wisdom power, not willpower. I've been teaching this all week. And what do? Something else. Whack, whack, whack. Here we go again. So please learn. And don't be like the stupid last horse. So you made a mistake once or twice. Learn from those mistakes and stop doing all this controlling. Just make peace, be kind, be gentle. Take it easy. And then you find you'll have that peace. You'll be grinning from ear to ear all day and night for the rest of this retreat. So that's what to do. So then you don't get any anxiety and you won't want anything at all in the whole world, then you'd be totally content. Dear Ajahn, do we can buy any Dharma books, CDs and t-shirts? Yes, you can buy the latest t-shirt. Our model, would you like to stand up and show the latest t-shirt? Da da da, the Jhana Grove, may peace be kind, be gentle. And please, don't just wear it. No, read it and follow it, for goodness sake. And CDs will be available, and a couple of Dharma books. There's a little quote book which came from Singapore. That's going to be on sale somewhere or other soon. And anyway, this is wildlife. The other day, three kangaroos flew over the perimeter fence. Next, birds fly. You're seeing flying kangaroos. I think you need to come and have a talk with me. No, they do jump over the fence. Next day I saw some creepies, at least two running beneath dry leaves. Today I saw a lady seated on the bare ground meditating in the bush. We need to remember, live as in serpentine. Okay, yes, so this is what happens. The animals here, they're very peaceful. They just make peace, be kind, be gentle. The kangaroos, do they talk? You do. So do we as silent as a kangaroo? Dear Venerable, according to last night's talk, we come from nothing and go to nothing. But as per physics, matter cannot be created nor destroyed. Energy is transformed. You mentioned ratio, plus and minus, or positive and negative energy. Omega is one. So in enlightened, omega is zero, means there is no negative or positive energy. So what happens to the energy if energy? Energy has to be transformed as per science. So in enlightenment, what happens to the energy? Please explain with metta. Exactly. Just like the consciousness. It comes from nothing. And right now, there is nothing. Just a balance of positive and negative. Which means it can come back to nothing. From emptiness to emptiness. And the illusion is to think there's somebody there. How many times has your husband told you, there's no one, nothing in there, is there, darling? You're empty. You say, yes! At last you've appreciated me, darling. So it's emptiness. Anatta, non-self, there's nothing in here. And oh, what bliss to realize there's no one in here. There is no Ajahn Brahm. It's just his emptiness, Ajahn Brahm. His nothingness. That's really nice to be able to be called your nothingness. So in this retreat, you're not here to gain things, you're here to let things go, to lose things. And the more you lose, the closer you get to enlightenment. So everyone who comes on this retreat are losers. And the monks and the nuns, we are the biggest losers. So be a loser, like me. And my advice to you is, please, get lost. And I'm saying that with the nicest wish for you. May you all get lost. In other words, there's nothing in there. It's just a play of positive and negative energies. And it's amazing to realize that. And that actually, in a very deep sense, those who like a bit of deep Dhamma in the evening instead of just jokes, that makes Nibbana, cessation, possible. If there was something here, if you existed, it could not cease, it could not go to nothingness. There'll always be something left. But if there's nothing here now, then it can stop with no rebirth. You cannot destroy energy, you cannot create energy. But if there's nothing there right now, then it can stop. The only things which can cease, which can stop, are empty processes. Processes with a core, with something there, they cannot cease without remainder. Seeing the emptiness of the five khandhas means it can stop. Da 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 da. That was deep. That's why you're not laughing. Dear, hooray, Ajahn, we found it. What is behind the Buddha in the bush? Interesting. What we'll find out tomorrow morning. Hey, thank you so much for the beautiful sight. Okay, that's the secret Buddha garden. Somebody has found a secret Buddha garden in the bush somewhere. Here we go. This is a book. Almost. No other question. Here we go. Anyway, I'm patient. Dear Ajahn, since childhood I've been an anxious and tense character. Me too. No, not really. As a student at uni, I got so bad that I found myself sitting in front of my studies, unable to move, paralyzed with terror. It was difficult for me to do basic functional things in the world, but I knew this was the case and forced myself into situations where I would have to learn and grow. Your teaching has been the most immense support. I would not have the quality of life I have now without you. Recently, I started to help an organization I care about. As I did this, my fears arose again. I used my practice, but even more recently, some stressful issues people have caused a great deal of tension to flood me. I'm wondering if I can keep serving this group in this way without the possibility of breaking down entirely. I've noticed this tension has always been manifesting in a long-standing physical ailment. I've noticed this is to do with wanting to do things well and dreadful fear of not doing so, and the result of this will be rejection and isolation. I've seen this in my meditation too. Get to the breath and quickly leave it, fearing I may not be able to be with it well. Sometimes this tension and stress gives me rise to headache across the brow, ill will, tension, fear mix with up. Deep apologies for the length of this. Can't say this in an interview with gratitude. Now this is so common, either with a lesser or greater degree with all people. We always feel we have to succeed. We always have to meet other people's expectations. At the least, we have to meet our own expectations and our own goals and standards. That's why I said this morning, see if you can not measure yourself. And then you can be at peace with yourself and just allow yourself to be. If you want to discover a great truth, you go out into the forest and you try and find a perfect tree in the forest around you. You can walk through the whole 140 acres of Jhana Grove and you will not find one perfect tree. They're leaning to the left, leaning to the right, branch falling off here, branch falling off over there, all sort of weird and strange and wounded. That is what makes the forest beautiful. If all those trees were perfectly straight, in lines and in rows, it would have been planted by the government, not by nature. And it looks terrible. But the so-called imperfections of a forest show you that the forest is beautiful, and maybe with all your imperfections, all the things which you think are wrong with you, at last you see are actually right with you. So now you don't try so damn hard to succeed and be perfect. You can make mistakes, you can be yourself. Look at me, I don't give a damn about what you think of my jokes. I'm going to say them anyway, that's why I'm at peace with myself. Other people are afraid to tell jokes. What would happen if you tell a joke and no one laughs? Happens to me very often. I just tell them anyway, I don't care. So this is where you should be aiming for. Aiming to a person who allows themselves to make mistakes. Allows yourself to be imperfect. Allows yourself to stuff up from time to time. And it's beautiful doing that. And if you always want to be perfect, that's where you get the anxiety from. You don't need to be perfect. You don't need to do it well. You don't need to always, you know, try and achieve things. So let all that stuff go. And you're learning that in this meditation. What works for meditation. Just make peace, be kind, be gentle. Don't try and make yourself perfect. Don't try and get rid of all these defilements and hindrances and stuff. Just make peace with them. Remember that story this morning? The emperor who came in to the demon's palace? Remember that to solve this anxiety and wanting to be perfect. You're imperfect, you make a mistake, a demon has come into your life. Don't go say, get out of here, you don't belong, I'm supposed to be perfect. No, welcome, monster. I really stuffed up today. Welcome. And be kind to the monsters of your life. And of course, you know what happens next. The monster gets smaller and smaller until it vanishes completely away. There's no more problem anymore. You realize you can fail. You can stuff up. You can make mistakes. And you have such a wonderful life. The way I learnt when I stuffed up in Thailand and made a mistake, did Ajahn Chah, my teacher, scold me? No. He laughed his head off. For example, the first year over there, it's a very poor monastery in those days, and if you wanted a bar of soap, you had to go and ask your teacher for a bar of soap. And he had just one of these big water jars. When people came and they offered him something, he just put it all in the water jar. And if he wanted something, like a battery, he'd just look in the jar. If there's something there, he'd give it to you. If there was, he'd say, sorry, there's nothing there. So I went for a bar of soap, because, you know, to wash with. And I said, I asked for a bar of soap. But I was only beginning to learn Thai. And I got the word slightly wrong. The word for soap in Thai is sabu. And I said, sapo. Very close together. But sapo means pineapple. So what Ajahn Chah heard, that I asked for a pineapple. And he looked at me, he's a very kind man, said, you know, what do you want a pineapple for? And the rest of it, I go, right, you know, to wash, you know, to bathe. And I caused him so much happiness for 2 or 3 days. He was telling all the visitors, these people in London, they wash with pineapples. And it's very strange culture. You know, in Thailand they use soap. But in the West, you know, they use pineapples to wash. Maybe they're more advanced than us, they're using pineapples. Maybe we should try that. And I realized, instead of scolding you, and I felt, instead of feeling bad, you know, that I made a stupid mistake or feeling embarrassed, I realized I'd made my teacher happy. So isn't it a wonderful thing? If you may do something stupid and make a mistake, you're making people happy. Make some more mistakes. It would be such a boring world if everyone was perfect and they could speak Thai properly. So this is this is actually why you don't have to have anxiety anymore. You make a mistake and let everybody else know. And just create so much happiness and joy in this world when you don't have to be perfect. And this, you'll learn that on this retreat. So your answer to that question is you do some more meditation in places such as this, and you'll find all your anxiety just vanishes. In the same way you meditate, yeah, just sit here and just let things be. You're not trying to get anywhere, just to be here. Allowing yourself to make mistakes. If you fall asleep, you fall asleep. If you start snoring, that's fine. If other people don't like it, they can get earplugs. You just carry on. That way that you don't really care what other people think of you. And you can just have a nice, peaceful, happy time. You don't have to be perfect. Oh, what a great relief on the spiritual journey of life to realize I don't have to be perfect. I can be free now. Otherwise, you're going to have to spend your whole of your life and many other lives striving for perfection, a place you can never reach, and realizing what a stupid person you'd be. You don't need to strive to be perfect. Just let go and you'll find it's good enough. Today, sitting by the secret garden, it's not secret anymore, everyone knows where it is now, I joyfully slapped dead the mozzie that had been biting me. Oops. Just as I pondered, you may have done it joyfully, I bet the mosquito didn't think it was joyful. Just as I pondered the rightness of killing, your door to the cottage opened and there appeared a kind and generous monk. When can killing be justified? And why aren't Buddhist vegetarians? Also, why do you only have chicken at the monastery and not other meat? I don't know. Sometimes we have other meat there, sometimes we have chicken, sometimes we have mosquito curry. I don't know what we have in there. No, it's the secret garden. You ponder right as killing, your door of the cottage opened, there appeared a kind and generous monk. That must be this guy. So, look, if you want to know why we shouldn't kill mosquitoes, ask the mosquito. And the mosquito will give you an answer. I'm too young to die. I've got a life. I don't want to die yet. Or do the mosquitoes, they want to die? Are they suicidal mosquitoes, do you reckon? And they come and they just say, kill me, please, please squash me. I really want to be squashed. Or do that, you know, they run away if they realize they're going to be squashed. So the reason we don't sort of do the killing is because the animals get afraid, just like you would get afraid. Imagine that there is these big beings with big hands and you were like mosquitoes and they started squashing you. Would that be fun? So be careful. In his book, Beyond Mindfulness in Plain English, Bhante Gunaratna states, there is virtually no evidence in the sutta that the Buddha came out of jhana to practice vipassana. He advises to attend to anicca, dukkha, anatta on a perceptual level whilst in jhana, particularly the fourth. Comments. Number one, you can't attend to these things while in the jhana. The jhanas are too still. I've argued with Bhanteji about that before. There's no evidence in the sutta you can contemplate within a jhana. Jhanas are too still. What you do is when you emerge from the jhana, you emerge from the jhana and the hindrances are suppressed. They're gone. You've got such a clear and powerful mind. You've got superpower mindfulness. And that's when you start to contemplate these things. But I'll give a talk about how you use that contemplation later on in the retreat. But you can't do anything within the jhanas. And you ponder them afterwards. That is the way it's always done. Lay people can get into jhana, become stream enter, and even enlightened. I didn't really see monastics practice that much better than lay people. If I'm really intended on the path, what is it there is any intrinsic benefit for practicing a monastic rather than as a lay person? Please give serious answers. That sucks asking serious answers. Look. The difference between the monks and nuns and you, we have renounced much more. We let go more. We let go of, sex. We let go of family. You know how hard that is to do. You know, you have people you really care about and love, your kids, even your husband, your wife. It was amazing. There was this one lady who was just such a dominant sort of wife to her husband. Her husband was called George. She was called Poonsup. I don't mind saying it because she's dead a long time. Both of them are dead now. When they would come to offer dana, she would say, George, George, you stupid man, come over here. George, do this. George, do that. In public. I felt so sorry for George. And then eventually, Bianca remembers George and Poonsup. Poor old George. And then she died. And I thought afterwards, oh, George, you must be so happy. And I thought to myself, no, I miss her so much. And I thought, this is crazy. She gave you such a hard time, but you get used to it and you love that. So, you're just crazy. I thought you'd be free of jail, but no, you pine for being in jail. But that's how attached you get. So you try being a monk or a nun. Can you do it? And actually shows us how much renunciation the monastics do. So it is not the same type of practice. You have to renounce much more. As a lay person, you can renounce. You can do 8 precepts and come here for 9 days. But then when you go back, you can watch your movies, catch up on what's happened in the cricket, and just eat whatever you want, whenever you want to eat it. It's very difficult to do that renouncing 100%. For full on for the rest of your life. That's why the amount of letting go monastics do is much more. That's why we have monastics. That's why the Buddha set up the Sangha. It's a faster, more thorough path of letting go. We don't have any money. We don't have fashion. We just wear our brown robes and that's it. It's a much more simple life. And that's why we have the Sangha. Dear Ajahn, I just found with the in-breath my upper body feels going up, feels going down with the out-breath. Is it okay? Yeah, I think it's okay like that. As long as you can be aware of your breath, it doesn't matter just what your body's up to, as long as you're aware of your breath. That's fine. The other night you said that nuns were called nuns because they get none of this and none of that. Then I realized why monks are called monks because they're always monkeying around, monkeying up and monkeying about, endless. Oh my goodness. That's the trouble. Nuns one, monks one. Okay. So in other words, they're just getting their own back for telling jokes about nuns. Did that come from one of you two? No answer, yeah. Anyway. You were trained in a different way in Thailand, e.g. waking up at 3 a.m, eating not so nutritious food, hot climate, than the way you provided here at China Grove. Does this mean, as we Westerners shouldn't go to more difficult or austere environments like Thailand or Burma to do meditation practice, or does this mean something else? What it means is you learn by the mistakes. It was far too tough. And seriously, there were many Westerners who probably would become good monks, nuns, who never made it because it was far too austere and they got sick. And we lost a lot of good possible monks and nuns because it was far too hard physically. And a lot of time, a person like Ajahn Chah never realized that because they'd never been to the West. They'd only known Northeast Thailand. Even people from Bangkok, they'd come up and they couldn't stay. It was far too hard. Like, even this is Thai people from Bangkok couldn't stand it. So, you know, the Westerners who did stay there for a long time, we were incredibly tough and, you know, blessed with good health. Otherwise, we'd never been able to endure it. And having been through that myself, you don't want to wish that on other people. So I saw that was going too far, too extreme. So when you come here, you know, I basically designed and built this place, Jhana Grove, and I did it because I want people to be comfortable. We've got an air con on here. We've got mosquito screens. You don't have to bother with mosquitoes, so you don't have to bother about squashing them. It's cool. You've got your own ensuite. And so I know that this works. You get much better meditation here. So please don't go into too much austerity. It's hard enough dealing with your mind. You know, with all the thoughts and restlessness and frustration, that's difficult enough without having to worry about your body. So this is just right. May I take this opportunity to congratulate you and your disciples on their various talents. Besides yourself and Ajahn being a master bricklayer, you have amongst your team carpenters, flooring specialists, water and drainage experts, to name but a few. And you have this monk who tells the most amazing funny jokes. Oh, I did that. Don't you appreciate the humour? You just say, I'm just a bricklayer. Okay. May I suggest you also advertise those skills as the Buddhist Builders Council, the BBC. Yes. Yes, we have many. And a lot of times, even building, it's just being mindful, being in the moment, and just using your common sense. So a lot of times, what you learn in meditation, you take out into your life, and it enhances whatever skills you have. Respected Ajahn Brahm, there are many traditions in Buddhism, like Theravada, Mahayana, Tantrayana, and so on. Were they all truly spoken by the Buddha himself? How to pick the truth amongst them with thanks? No, you try and put all those traditions together. And my tradition, you all should know, I haven't said it yet, the three traditions of Hinayana, Mahayana, and Vajrayana, I take the H from Hinayana, the Aha from Mahayana, and the Yana from Vajrayana. And what does that spell? The Hahayana, which is my tradition. Putting all those traditions together and making it a fun path, which is brilliant. So, no, a lot of them weren't taught by the Buddha himself. What the Buddha taught was Four Noble Truths, Eightfold Path. Keep it simple. The more simple it is, the more likely it is to be Buddhist. How can you recall past lives but have no soul? Is the analogy of the candle being lit with another telling us that it is energy that leaves us to enter another life? And if the energy has a memory, why can't we call that a soul? You can call it a soul if you want to, but the nice simile is the stream of consciousness. That's what the Buddha called what goes from one life to another, a stream of consciousness. And the stream like any other river. It looks the same day after day after day, but the water you see today is totally different than the water you saw yesterday. Just like the stream of consciousness, it looks the same, but it is totally different from day to day, minute to minute. So that's why you say you can call it a soul if you wish, the stream of consciousness, but it hasn't got any essence which is always there, hasn't got something which was there yesterday which is here again today. So look, if you get the idea of a stream, like a river, then you understand the idea where the Buddha didn't call it a soul, because there's nothing essential there. There's nothing stable, always there from day to day to day to day, which is really what a soul means. It's something always in flux, always moving, no core to it, just like a river. So if you understand that, you can understand that's how reincarnation happens. The stream of consciousness goes to a new body. What means seven times reborn? We can become Buddha and counting from which life? Oh my goodness me. That's a stream winner. If you get the first stage of enlightenment, you only have how many more births? How many more births?
Six.
Ah, oh, you've heard me before. I'm trying to trick you. It's six more births, because seven lives, and this is number one. So you count this life as number one, you have six more births, and that makes a seven. So now that's if you're a stream winner. Six more births. But we'll see that later on. I'll maybe talk a bit about stream winning later on. But don't worry about that. Don't try and be somebody. Being a stream winner, once returning, non-returning, arahat, full enlightenment, is just how much you've disappeared, how much you've vanished. It's a sign of how much you've got lost. You get lost a little bit, you're a stream winner. You really lose a heap of things, you may be a once returner. You're almost all disappeared, and you're a non-returner. And you're totally gone, then you're an arahat. So just please lose it on this retreat. I was going to say, that's a Bob, you've lost it. Yes! Okay. Dear Ajahn, please explain how the present moment creates the future. Where is your future made? Right now. So if you want to be peaceful, happy, wise, it's a waste of time thinking about the future. Now is the only time you can do anything about your future. Right now. This is where your future is being built. Right this moment. It's obvious when you look at it that way. If you care about your future, if you really want a lot of peace, happiness, wisdom, good health for your future, pay more attention to the place your future is being made right now. Dear Ajahn, can you remind people about the eight precepts? The perfume was too sharp and I couldn't meditate. I tried to let go again and again and finally I left my seat go. May you be well and happy. That's not perfume. That is just you get such strong meditation that even shit smells like Chanel number 5. This is so beautiful. So sometimes that's what happens when you get strong meditation. Everything smells fragrance. At least I hope that's the cause, because if someone's still using perfume, you don't need to use perfume on this retreat. You're not going to attract anybody on this retreat, so throw all that perfume away and just use water, soap, that's good enough. But it may be that somebody, they're getting into deep meditation, because when you get into deep meditation, you do become fragrant. Just like Ajahn Brahm, the fragrant one. But anyway, so please don't do any perfumes. On entering the fourth jhana, does one receive a spectacular energy rush, similar to entering the first? Not spectacular, just so subtle and peaceful and still. The deeper you go, the more subtle it is. Powerful, but far more refined. Dear Ajahn, I've been thinking, read about emptiness from the famous Buddhist philosopher Nagarjuna. Would you recommend it? Too complicated, please comment. If it really was a good description of emptiness, you'd open up that sutta and there'll be nothing there. Now that is real emptiness. There's the old story of this monk. in a long time ago, and he was really hungry, he hadn't had anything to eat for a long time. And he went on arms round, and someone told him, yeah, we haven't got any food here, but if you go to the restaurant over there, it's a really good restaurant, the owner is a Buddhist, and she will probably give you a nice meal. So he went into the restaurant, and he could smell the food, delicious food. And she asked to see the owner, and the owner said, you're a monk? He said, yes, I'm a monk. I'm a Buddhist too, but I want to make sure you're a good monk. Teach me some Dhamma. And if I like the Dhamma you teach, I will give you a big meal on the house. So the monk, he taught the Heart Sutra. Form is emptiness. Emptiness is form. Sadhu, sadhu, she said. That is so deep. Everything is emptiness. Sit down. And he sat down and began salivating. And he started thinking of the food he's going to get. And she came out with a big platter all by herself. You know, like you do in these restaurants, with a cover on it to keep it warm. And she offered it to the monk, and when she took the cover off, the platter was empty. If form is emptiness, and emptiness is form, eat emptiness, monk. And that's what happens when people get too intellectual. They haven't got the difference between what emptiness is and what sort of real things are. So be careful. Don't go into too much philosophy. Instead, practice. Otherwise, like the other story I tell every retreat, did I tell that already about the professor went to the restaurant? On this retreat? No, I think I told that in Korea. There was a professor who went to a restaurant, I thought in Singapore. It was a 5-star restaurant, and the professor went to his table, and the waiter gave him the menu. And the menu was written in calligraphy on thick parchment, a nice little red border on it. The menu looked so amazing, so beautiful, so tastefully done, as you would expect in a fancy restaurant. This wasn't McDonald's. This was a fancy 5-star restaurant. So the professor said thank you to the waiter, and then the professor ate the menu, paid his bill, and left. And the reason he did that was because professors don't know the difference between the menu and the food. Same with scholars. They may know Nagarjuna. They may be Pali and Sanskrit experts. They may have translated the Chinese Agamas into Swahili. But they never actually understood what they're translating. They've just eaten menus and they've never ever tasted the food. So what you're doing here with meditating, you're actually tasting the food. You're eating it. Instead of just learning it and translating it and just reading menus all the time. So a menu is okay, you can see what you're going to eat, but for goodness sake, as soon as you read the menu, don't translate it and write a dissertation, a PhD on the menu. No, order some food for goodness sake and eat it. So meditate, let go, and then you eat the food rather than eating the menu. Why do we see dreams during sleep? Because you're sleeping too much. Usually the case, you know, because most dreams occur just before you wake up, because you're sleeping too much. Is there meaning according to Buddhism? No. Does it come from my subconscious? Maybe. Can we stop coming these dreams by developing, keeping calm my mind? In other words, by meditating. You can stop having these dreams by not sleeping so much. Nah, it's okay. If you have dreams, that's just what happens. So it's all right. Have dreams, but don't take them seriously. They're just dreams, that's all. So they're just like, you know, bad movies. They're not good movies, are they? Come on, be honest. Just like looking at a bad movie. And just as soon as it goes, just let it go. Dear Venerable Ajahn Brahm, I read that the Buddha established the first ever religious order for women. Is that true? It makes him one of the first feminists, a fighter for equality, which I thoroughly approve. Why then are Buddhist nuns so often overlooked when it comes to funding and support? I propose a fundraiser in the style of the world's greatest shave to raise money for our nuns' monastery. Is there anything else we could do to help? I tried this on the last fundraiser I did. I told a story from Ajahn Chah. It's a great story, It was of this man from Sydney who had heard about Ajahn Chah and wanted to go and visit him, to see him personally. So he managed to find out, you know, get a flight to Bangkok, and then find out in Bangkok that Ajahn Chah lived up in the northeast, managed to get the train up to Warin Chamrap, and then get a taxi driver, where's Ajahn Chah, to the actual the temple. It's a real expedition to get up there. And when he got up there to the monastery, he found out where Ajahn Chah was, and he was where he always used to be during the daytime, under his hut, receiving guests, people coming from all over Thailand, and a few from foreigners, asking questions about all sorts of things, usually about, you know, the marriage, the business, you know, because you're supposed to be a wise person. It really wastes people's time when you're wise, instead of asking about meditation, all sorts of stupid stuff. But Ajahn Chah was kind, so he'd answer all his questions, and this guy had some important questions to ask, but couldn't get close. Ajahn Chah was surrounded by 100 or 200 people. And after waiting there for 1 or 2 hours, he realized he'd wasted his journey. Come all that way just to see Ajahn Chah, nothing else. So he decided to leave. And as he left, he saw somebody of the monks doing some sweeping. And he thought, at least I can do some good karma in the temple, help sweep some leaves or something to make my trip worthwhile. And this was actually an important part. He was actually doing some good karma. He's not just thinking for himself, but actually to help out. So he was sweeping, and then he felt this hand on his shoulder. He turned around, the hand belonged to Ajahn Chah. Ajahn Chah was going to another appointment, had realized this Westerner had come all this way, and to stop just for in a minute to give him a teaching. And this Australian guy, he told me here in Serpentine Monastery years and years ago what a powerful teaching that was, even though it was so short. Ajahn Chah told him, if you're going to sweep, give it everything you've got. And then he left. And he realized it's not just sweeping. If you're working, doing your job, give your work everything you've got. If you're meditating, you're not working. If you're meditating, sit down, let go, be still, give it everything you've got. If you're eating, give eating your full attention, everything you've got. If you're resting, you're in bed at night, you're resting for goodness sake, you're not meditating, you're not working. Give resting everything you've got. And I told that story at our last Katina ceremony when we're raising funds. I say, look, if you're making a donation to the Nuns Monastery, give it everything you've got, as Ajahn Chah said. He said, no, no, no. It almost worked, but it never did. So it actually does seem to be, it's uncertain, the Buddha wasn't the first person. There was a lot of wanderers, Paribhajakas who were female, and even Jains who were female. So it was actually par for the course in that time to have people from different genders practicing religion. It wasn't such a big deal. So we wonder actually, did the Buddha actually start it or not? But certainly, certainly he did sort of say, yes, we're going to do it. So he was a feminist. And it is true. And that, I mentioned this the other day, that the Theravada bhikkhunis, nuns you see in front of you here, this is historic. How many monasteries for monks have we got, even in Perth? We've got heaps of them. We've got the Sri Lankan in Kenwick. We've got about 3 or 4 Burmese temples. We've got a Cambodian temple. And we've got quite a few Mahayana temples. But actually, monasteries for nuns are very, very rare, and it is historic. So I'm really trying to get people throughout the world, please, some of the monasteries you see for monks, now our monastery is simple, we've kept it that way, but you see some of these monasteries, and they really are elaborate, and they really go over the top. You know, that monastery in Wollongong, the Chinese temple, I mean, that's like a palace. Buddhist monastery shouldn't be like that. It's a great tourist attraction. you know, built in Chinese style, huge. And there's only about two or three nuns who stay in it.
Nantian,
yeah. So there's only one or two people stay in it. What a waste of money. When we've got a whole big waiting list of people wanting to become bhikkhunis or stay in Dhammasara, there's no place for them to stay. So they have to be... Now, Pasada, I mean, you're very lucky. You've been accepted in. There's other people like Munisara just can't get in there. Now, Munisara, a really beautiful Thai nun, can't get in there. There's no space. So that's why we are really going for broke. That's actually why I went to Korea, just killing myself trying to raise money for the nuns' monastery. So I really want it to happen. So this is no joke, serious. If you want to make any donations, yeah, the only way to do it is for the nuns' monastery. And they have to be, you know, having a shave, yeah, it raises a few dollars here and there, but that doesn't really pay the bills. So it has to be, you know, the real big ones. In your lifetime, $1,000 here, $2,000 there. That's what builds these monasteries. Not the $10 and $20. I'm being straight up with you guys. That's the only way it works. Because, you know, you need a huge amount of money for that. And look, you can't take it with you. And when you think about what you've done in your life, and this is something, don't give it to Bodhinyana. Okay, Jhana Grove, Daniel will get upset at me here, you know, because he always needs stuff for Jhana Grove. But to do something which is historic, which is going to make a real difference. And I don't mind saying this, because I did my sacrifice. I got kicked out of Wat Pa Pong for ordaining the nuns. So I don't mind saying I stood up and got hurt by it. So I don't mind saying I got hurt. I could make that sacrifice, losing a lot of very close friends, to make sure the bhikkhunis have their ordination. So because I've done that, I don't mind asking you guys to also, you know, to make a sacrifice. When I was a layman, a nun, she was a Tibetan nun, came and gave a talk just about the orphanage she was running in Kalimpong, in Sikkim, in North India. And I was so inspired, I got £20 out of my bank account the next day to give her a donation. That was 2 weeks' food money for me. It was actually more than that, maybe 3 weeks' food money, which meant I went hungry for 2 weeks. I never starved, but I never had as much to eat as I normally would. And that hurt. And that was one of the best donations I'd ever given. I'd never forgotten that, because it was not easy to make. So that's why when you make a donation which hurts you, and it really makes a dent in your balance, then that's really good karma. So for the nuns' monastery. And I guarantee that you will never, ever regret it. When you die, you think, what have I done in my life? And what service have I really given? You've helped build a monastery for nuns where there is very, very, very rare to find one. Monks' monasteries, thousands throughout the world. Nuns' monasteries, where are they? They're very rare. There's one over, they're trying to get one in BSV, whether they get one or not, I'm not sure. They're trying to get one in Melbourne. There is a very, very poor one in the United States, which I'm really upset that people don't support that more. We've got Dhammasara, which has really got the land, it's got the people, just needs the buildings. So there we go. It's a hard sell, but I don't mind doing that because I'm right behind it all the way. I'm killing myself for this place, so please you kill yourself with me.
Sadhu.
Sadhu, 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 yeah, okay. Adamani, yeah. Dear Ajahn, is fear a type of ill will? Yeah, fear is it a type of ill will? It's an ill will to losing control. Because, you know, fear and control always go together. And you know, if you let go of controlling, you don't have any fear anymore. You just, who cares what's going to happen? So, you know, the story I told before, holding the bike wheels when I was young, I first got my bicycle, my knuckles went white, I got so stiff I kept on falling off. I was afraid of falling off when I got a bicycle at 11 years of age. I think I told that story in Singapore, not here. So every time I got on my bicycle when I was 11 years old, I kept falling off, kept falling off, kept falling off. And I realized, because I was too stiff, I was afraid that made me stiff, and that was the cause of falling off. And soon you just forget about falling off, which meant you relax, and when you relax, you never fell off. It was a fear of falling off kept pushing me off. And I realized that as an 11-year-old. As soon as you let go, you had nothing to be afraid of. And there was a time, you know, going out with girls, see a beautiful girl, and you want to sort of chat to her. You're afraid! Ah! And because you were afraid of what she thought of you, you went up and said something stupid, mangled all your words. And that never worked. You know, you've heard that before. And after all, I think that's no way to deal with it. So I don't care if she likes me, she doesn't like me, I'm just going to go out and chat about anything. And then when you had, you know, relaxed and had confidence, you got lots of girlfriends then. You realised that fear was the thing which was the worst possible thing to do. So you let go of fear, and then everything started going smoothly. It was all about control. So fear has been a big hindrance in my life and seems to relate to a lack of confidence to do things in life, including letting go when powerful images appear. Please explain much better. Fear, it disappears when you learn just how to let go and you're not afraid of making mistakes. As I said, that when you make a mistake, tell everybody and it's really funny. You're allowed to make mistakes. It's okay to fall off the bike and then you don't fall off anymore. But when you're afraid of falling or afraid of making mistakes, you make too many mistakes. I've made that a very important point in Bodhidharma Monastery. I told monks, you're allowed to make mistakes. And when I allow them to make mistakes, they don't make as many. But you know what it's like, you know, monks down there, if I was really on your back all the time, turning you off every time you made a mistake, you're so afraid of making mistakes, you would make heaps more. But when you say, you can make mistakes if you like, it's okay, you know, I made mistakes, I did stupid things, so you can do stupid things as well. And then you create that sort of atmosphere, no one makes mistakes, because they are relaxed. So actually this is what you learn in meditation. With metta mindfulness, one is at peace with any noise, echoes in a meditation, or just sit in blissful, bright spaciousness, with appreciation for your kind guidance, side to side to side, exactly. That's what I was saying this morning, put loving kindness on your breath, loving kindness on anything. Open the door of your heart to the noise. Any monster which disturbs your meditation, give it kindness. Welcome noise, welcome heat, welcome mosquito, whatever it is. Welcome bad jokes. And then the bad jokes get less and less and less and less. But if you're afraid of them, they get more. If you're not afraid, then they disappear. Ah, this is a good one. Yes. And this interesting one. Dear Ajahn Brahm, I am married, but I'm having feelings and thoughts romantic about a colleague. I notice the pleasure in fantasy, but see it's a waste of time. Help. What are the karmic consequences of adultery? Why is that so interesting? The karmic consequences of adultery are terrible. You lose all your money, the lawyers get everything. And, oh gee, it's just a waste of time. So, you're having feelings, thoughts about a colleague. It's the thoughts which are fun, aren't they? The fantasies. But please remember, don't take them seriously, because what you fantasize about your colleague is not what they're really like. If you go and run away with them, you will be terribly disappointed. In fantasy land, we can make them up to be whatever we like. In the fantasy world, we can make just this ordinary person look like Angelina Jolie, the big breasts and everything. But when you actually go and see her, they find they're all fake. They're just these padded bras or whatever else they have these days. It's not really true. So disappointed. You got into trouble for that. So don't even think like that. It's just fantasies. And you know, you should know by now, all your fantasies are just that. Just exaggeration of the real world. It's not true. So don't buy into it. I have enough experience now. It's amazing, even though I've never been married. You talk to people who are married. All husbands, all men, they are exactly the same. So don't think that your colleague is somehow different than a man you've got already. You think, oh, my husband, he's just boring, but this guy's really interesting. After a couple of days, oh, here we go again, just like my husband, no better. And the same with all girls, they're the same as well. They may have a different chassis, but the engine's the same. Nag, 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 nag. So stick with the one you've got. It's much cheaper. And I tell you that with authority. So don't get into that. It's just fantasy. Little by little, my mind is calming down, getting rid of depression. But during the night, I have these terrible nightmares related to my depression issues. Thank you. Okay, so meditate during the night and sleep during the day. Maybe. Will that work? No, probably won't work. No, so when you go to bed at night, just condition your mind, do a bit of loving kindness when you go to bed at night. May all beings be happy and well. May all beings be free of suffering. May the whole world be at peace. Get a nice sort of beautiful thoughts as you go to sleep. And if you have beautiful thoughts when you go to sleep, you'll have beautiful dreams. And rest. You deserve a rest. So have a nice sleep. And then whatever dreams you have, if you have dreams at all, will always be beautiful dreams. So do a little bit of positive reaffirmation just before you fall asleep. Or what some people do, and I'm a bit embarrassed about this, but apparently it works. They get my talks and they play it to themselves before they go to bed and then they fall asleep. That's really a downer when people said that. Yeah, I use your talks to get me to sleep at night. Oh my goodness. But I suppose they have a peaceful sleep, so it's good enough. So you can try that. Get some copy of my talks and then play it to yourself in bed. And then you probably have a very peaceful sleep. But you may have a nightmare about the joke. Oh no, not that joke again. Ah! You wake up in a sweat. No, you won't. So try that before. Because it gives you positive input before you go to sleep so you don't have nightmares. And that's seriously. Try, say, one of my talks. Is it true that you can send metta through meditation to someone far away and that person will feel it? Yes, of course they can. It's amazing. You get one of these little boxes with lights on and you talk into it and somebody, a long way away, they can actually hear it. It's a miracle. So if you can do that with these little boxes, I'm sure you can do something with your mind. Yes, you can do it. Dear Ajahn, I understand that rowing? Oh, bowing. Oh, bowing? Yeah, bowing. It's a sign of respect and admiration and part of the tradition and culture where Buddhism started and has spread. Could you please explain why we are bowing so many times? To me it seems a little bit over the top, and for newcomers could be a bit confusing and scary. Did the Buddha say anything about this subject? What do you think? The reason we bow, as I said here, is because of Bianca and all the dana we're getting here, which is very, very delicious, many of you are putting on weight. And because you're putting on, you know you're putting on weight, because you're putting on weight, you need to do lots and lots of bowing because that exercises the tummy muscles and actually balances all the extra food which you're eating. So because you eat so much, bow, 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 as much as you can. If you aren't eating that much, you don't need to bow so much. So if you have the extra, a bit of sweet or the extra piece of toast in the morning, please, every piece of toast, 3 bows. Thank you for guiding me to let go of fears. The samadhi remained for a long time when I left the sitting to walking. I couldn't see the carpets at all. It was all black with lots of metta. Excellent. That's actually the fear of what happens when you get into deep meditation. Well, you've got nothing to fear. Everything's a gain. So when you start getting peaceful, let go and enjoy to the max. That's what you're here for. And everybody who's had deep meditation says, wonderful, wonderful, please join all the deep meditators, which means you have to let go of fear and just have fun. Last question. Speaking of confession, can you please tell the joke of the 4 monks who encourage each other to confess their worst precepts? Much better for all your jokes. You know that joke, don't you? Okay, here we go. There were these 4 monks. There's too many here. There were these 4 monks. And just after the talk, they were sitting having a cup of tea. And they would say, in all these other religions, they confess. And it's wonderful. If we could actually open up. Actually, it doesn't work with monks. So it's actually, I heard this with Catholic priests. Poor old Catholics, they really get a hard time from Buddhist monks, but it actually works much better with Catholic priests. Okay, they're already in enough trouble in this world today, so a bit more won't do them any harm. So the four Catholic priests, and they're sitting having a cup of tea, and they said, no, you know, we receive all these confessions from others, you know, we should, you know, sort of, you know, confess our own faults. And he said, the reason I'm saying this is because there's something been on my chest. And I really, really just, I need to open up to you. And he said, the problem is that, you know, gambling. You know, just some of the collections I get on a Sunday. On a Monday I go to the racetrack. I gamble. And I'm actually in a bit of debt too. Unfortunately, I'm a terrible gambler. It's an addict. You know that some people have this. It's like an addict. It's like a sickness. And the other priest said, okay, it's a wonderful thing that you had the courage at last to let us know what you were doing. Because now we may be able to help you. And the second priest said, gee, I don't really know whether I should say this, but because you've been courageous, I'll be courageous too. I've got a problem too. And the problem is alcohol. Any wine left over after Mass, glug, glug, glug. And not only that, I go to the bottle shop of a Sunday night, and a Monday morning I'm plastered. I'm an alcoholic, he said. And the other priest would say, that's incredible, we never knew, you hid it so well, but it's a terrible thing that someone in your position who teaches other people to be moderate, that you're an alcoholic. But it's a great thing you tell us. Now maybe opening up like that, you may be able to do something about it. Then they asked the third priest, okay, what's your worst sin? He said, look, please, don't ask me. He said, oh, come on, you know, two of us have told you, at least you can say. So he said, okay, I suppose it's a good thing I confess. It is adultery. There's a woman in my parish. She's got a husband. We've been having an affair. It's consensual. We love each other. I know I shouldn't do that. I'm a priest. They were shocked. It's a terrible thing that you've done that, but at least you've been honest enough to confess. And then they asked the fourth priest, and the fourth priest looked at his watch. It's time I went now. Bye-bye. He said, no, you can't go. We've, been courageous enough to confess. You confess what your worst sin is. He said, look, I cannot tell you. He said, oh, please, it can't be anything as bad as gambling, alcoholic, or adultery. And he said, it's much worse than any of those. When I tell this story, you can actually start thinking, what could it be? Which is worse, and it is worse than gambling, adultery, and addicted to alcohol. He said, please, you must tell us. Look, don't ask me, please don't. He said, you must tell us. Okay, he said, I warned you. My worst sin is I'm a gossip. Ah, they told him. So you can see how being a gossip is worse than adultery, alcoholism, or gambling. He's going to tell everybody what those fish were up to. So that's why, please don't be a gossip. What you hear here, don't repeat anywhere else. Just not what you have told me during your interviews. I promise you, I will not repeat it anywhere. Especially not to your partner. As long as you give a big donation to the nun's monastery. No, I don't do blackmail. Okay, thank you for listening. It's gone on a bit long tonight, 9:30, so have a beautiful night. There's been some serious questions there, but a lot of fun and games. And I don't mind doing fun and games on a, because you've all been, it's a long day, and you've all been meditating a lot. Some of you are very tired. It's nice to have a positive energy before you go to bed, so you won't have any nightmares. You have a peaceful night, maybe wake up in the middle of the night laughing. When you finally get one of my jokes. I get it now. And have a beautiful night and see you in the morning.
Sadhu,
sadhu, sadhu.
Excellent.
Are you going to take it back tonight? Somebody else wanted to. Who's going to? Okay. Who's going to have it tonight? I think it was. It was Ling tonight. So I give the teddy bear morning, afternoon, or night time for those people who need a bit more loving kindness. Ling, I'll probably choose the teddy bear for the afternoon or night time. For anyone who wants to practice loving kindness meditation, you can borrow the teddy bear. Does anyone want to borrow the dog? So if you want to borrow the dog's here looking for a home for tonight.
Okay.
Well, good night, everybody.